coming up this weekend from Vegas, UFC Fight Night, Song versus Simone. I mean, we have a 12-fight slate coming at you from the UFC's Apex facility. A lot to break down going all the way from the bottom of the card up to the top. You are going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. As we always say, let's get into it. And just like that, we're back with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half of your host, Noah Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. And listen, I mean, this is the second card in a row from the UFC's Apex facility, and it was originally supposed to be Hanato Moicano versus Armin Tsarukyan, but Moicano is out. So all of a sudden, last weekend's co-main event that was scheduled for Pavlovich versus Blades, it was Song versus Simone. It's promoted to a main event slot. Now it's going to be five rounds. So all of a sudden for Song Yadong, I mean, this is a guy 19-7-1 on the record. It is very shiny, but he's the one that's coming off of a recent main event. That was his first main event in the UFC against Corey Sandhagen. Ricky Simone kind of getting back into the swing of the five round type of things from the time when he was an LFA champ before he came into the UFC. But when we look up and down this entire card, it is very much in flux. It is very fluid. Over the wire on Saturday night, out is Ange Alosa, and in is the, and I say recent, like as of a couple of weeks ago, welterweight champ over with the LFA, Trey Waters. He's going to be taking on Joshua Quinlan. There's a lot to look forward to. All of a sudden now there's five UFC debuts on a card that only has 12 fights, but a lot to look forward to for the fight fans.
And I think there's some sneaky kind of fight of the night, even fight of the fight of the month contenders. I think that should be a new category, you know, fight of the nights that they might not be in the fight of the year categories, but we're definitely excited for them. And we think that they will stand out a little bit more. I know for me, Julia DeRosa versus Fernando Padilla is going to be an amazing fight. And I think there's other fights similar to that where kind of hidden diamonds in a landmine.
Matt, I mean, listen, let's cut the shiznit if you want to go that way. Wow. We'll just cut the entire intro. We're talking about a main event, Song versus Ricky Simone. We had this last week as a possible fight of the night. But Matt, I mean, Barry in the lead. He hasn't even seen the screen. Julian Arosa versus Fernando Padilla is one that you can't miss. And for Padilla, he hasn't fought since 2021. Visa issues have been the reasoning. It hasn't been injuries. He's continued to train at Team Oyama. I mean, Colin Oyama all of a sudden pops up in all of these superstar mega corners. So it's awesome to see that for Mexico's Padilla. And we even saw a Latin American fighter struggle with visa issues recently, come back into the UFC and just set the world on fire. And that was Ignacio Bahamondes against one Trey Ogden. So Padilla's got a great opportunity coming up against a 12-fight UFC vet in his third stint with the promotion. And Julian Rosa's last time out fought Alex Caceres, who was ranked earlier on in the week. And then they scrapped his ranking. But in that fight, Arosa was actually favored to beat Caceres. So when you look at a matchup like this, Fernando Padilla, who hasn't fought since a year and a half, all of a sudden gets to take on the number 16th ranked guy in the featherweight division. It's crazy to look at that.
It's a super fun fight for those reasons, though, and hopefully if you guys stick around for that prediction video, you'll learn a little bit more as to why Padilla is such a fun prospect.
So many big-time fights. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in the fight of the night. So when you go up and down through this card, again, there's a lot of debuts. In the co-main event, too, Caio Bojalio, fourth fight in the UFC, going to be his third co-main event. He's taking on Husar, Michael Olajczyk. If you look through it for all of the debuts, the aforementioned Trey Waters is one of them to kick off the card. It's the third time to kickstart Haley Cowan's career.
Is it weird that I'm really excited for Brian Kelleher versus Jody Newsom?
That has nothing to do with debuting fighters. Jamelyn Horth also making the debut. Arina Alexeva and Fernando Padilla. And yes, Matt, Brian Keller is taking on Journey Newson for a I want to hold on to my job type of fight. There is a lot of action coming up this weekend. Question Mark Kicks, as always, is 2 hours before the prelims. You can find that here on the channel. Make sure you toss out a like on this video. We got to try and get that going on the channel. We got a lot to talk about. You're not going to want to miss any of it. So keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. And to kick off the prelims coming up this weekend, a couple of debuts at bantamweight. You might think, hey, it's time for that record scratch. Yes, it is. All hail Haley Cowan, the third attempt to make the walk. She's going to be taking on
Squamish British Columbia's own Jamie Lynn Horth. If you go over to these women's Instagrams, Horth Wessels and also Haley Cowan Brennan, but when you have a look at the matchup like this as it is, I mean, you consider these two fighters, they're both on win streaks for Jamie Lynn Horth. I mean, this is kind of an odd fight because we haven't seen her in a cage in a very meaningful amount of time. She's had multiple layoffs throughout her career, but the last time that we did see Jamie Lynn Horth, she was going out there, she was winning the LFA flyweight belt. So now all of a sudden, she jumps up to bantamweight, she takes this fight with Haley Cowan, and I have a trouble here with fighting Apex, Matt. I get kind of stuck and I get dug in and I dig those boot heels in and I decide, listen, I've thought of this fighter in such and such a way and I have a hard time breaking that mold. For this fight, I'm not kidding myself nor the fighting Apex fans. I'm not going to drop a clip of us talking about Haley Cowan when she was supposed to take on Aileen
Perez. We've talked about her a lot though for some reason.
Or Tamiris Vidal. I watched all 9 pro fights. I watched all 9 pro fights. I went all the way down through it. And if you look at it for Haley Cowan and you look at all of these fights and you consider the background that she has coming into MMA, it's a little weird. It's kind of like Charles Johnson that you're also going to find on this card, because for Haley Cowan, she goes to Baylor. She's a multiple-time All-American in acrobatics and tumbling gymnastics. She parlays that into becoming an amateur. She wins all of her amateur fights, goes 3-0, takes her first pro fight, favored by the commentary team and the fans, takes on Victoria Leonardo. There's a lot of back and forths in that one. Cowan starts to initiate a lot of the grappling exchanges. But in the final one, it's Leonardo bucking her down to the ground. Leonardo getting into the advantageous position and getting the submission win. And from there, Cowan goes on a streak, beating Shaw Whittington, Jessica Stotak, Sarah Click, Jessica Middleton, Brittany Cloudy in a fight that I thought Cloudy had won 2 of the rounds. She fights Kelly Clayton, and she's a giant favorite, is Haley Cowan. She loses that fight by submission, and it was kind of a crazy fight, just all things considered. She beats Monica Franco over with Invicta, an older fighter who had a lengthy layoff, gets a finish there. She beats Claudia Leitchi in her fight on Dana White's Contender Series this past summer, and Dana White signs her. And then I went back and I thought, okay, Dana likes to give these quotables. Sometimes they're a mystery to us, but sometimes they're really good. Dana White said, this fight is obviously not a, you know, the knockdown, drag them out fights that I'm looking for on the, you know, Contender Series. And I think Haley is a solid athlete. And I can't put my finger on it, but I like everything about her. And I'm going to give her a shot. Really, really great words from the president. So, Matt,
not a great sales pitch.
Watched a lot of tape, obviously, on both of these women. But I went back and did the review of Haley Cowan's entire career. And she's gotten better throughout. And I have a more positive look on it than I did going into the Perez and Vidal fights.
Not lighting the world on fire, though. And that's the interesting thing about this fight. They both are quite well-rounded, I will say that. It's not like they have this one area that really stands out where it's, oh, I think Haley Cowan's going to, you know, go in there and just completely outbox Horth. But I will think ranges are going to be important because I think Cowan can have more success up close. Horth is someone who will mix her kicks in a little bit more. She likes to go to the body. She likes to go to the leg a little bit more. So I do think those kicks, since they are a more essential component of her game, it will be interesting to see if she can keep that range, because if they are both just going for a lot of those, not sloppy takedown attempts, but just takedowns off of clinches, not a lot of the more traditional, like, single and double legs, I think we will get a lot of even positions out of that, so it might just come down to the volume game at the end of the fight.
I mean, there were a lot of things to kind of, you know, break down when you're watching these Cowan fights, and at the start, it was kicks to close the distance to clinch, and she goes for a lot of takedowns, but her takedown offense isn't all that great, especially where
she... Does it remind you of Mackenzie Dern before she had kind of fixed it a little bit? It's just a lot of volume, a lot of looseness on the legs and whatnot.
Cowan has a strong upper body. She's obviously well-built for bantamweight. We know that she's the bigger fighter in the majority of her fight. She'll be the bigger fighter coming up this weekend, although the height and the reach stats are very close, and you have a flyweight moving up to bantamweight. And in this fight, Horth's had a lot of time to do it. But for Cowan, the trouble is, she holds her hands really wide, she keeps her head directly on the center line, she doesn't move her body or her head in unison, and that can get her caught. And I mean, in some of these fights, the fight against Brittany Cloudy, where she wins by split decision, it's Cloudy's boxing, and it's the clinch work and takedown attempts that don't really initiate much from Cowan Brennan. So again, I scored 2 rounds of that fight for Cloudy on the rewatch. It kind of opened my eyes a little bit, because somebody like Brittany Cloudy, who's long and rangy and strikes with force, That's what Jamie Lynn Horth does in a lot of her fights. And Horth's one of those fighters who is very well-rounded in the game. And if you go back and you look through Horth's wins, again, she is only 5-0 as a pro. She competed with TKO in Quebec. She was a BFL champ as well as with the LFA. But the names that pop up, the last three names, Jade Mason Wong, Maeda Cantuaria, and Corinne Laframboise, those are very meaningful names. Those women fought good levels competition. And even in the fight against Corinne Laframboise back in 2019, Laframboise was winning the fight.
She was.
Until she didn't in the very end in the third round.
This is the thing about Horth that I don't enjoy about her striking game. It's a little mechanical. Like, if you are stuck at long range, she will have success because she'll use her punches in unison with her kicks. But that's why I do think if Cowan can get on the inside, get on the outside, can disrupt some of that rhythm, she can have success even on the feet, because Horth is someone who, it's a lot of 1-2 kick, a lot of kind of set combinations. So I will be curious to see if the movement of either athlete kind of stifle the striking game of their opponent.
Yeah, and you consider, I mean, for both of them coming into the UFC, I said Horth's level of competition was pretty good. The records might not necessarily suggest it, but you got to look into it a little bit deeper. For Cowan, it was the same conversation coming into Dana White's Contender Series. Combined opponent record was 20-17-1, and the average opponent's age was 30 years old. And if you look at it for Jamie Lynn Horth, I mean, a 22-month layup between the Mason Wong fight and the fight against Maeda Cantuaria. And that's a really long layoff. She was then supposed to take on, last December, Sabina Mazow, who's somebody that's kind of been in the mix over with the LFA. That fight didn't materialize. So now, from December 2021 until now, another long layoff for Jamie Lynn Horth. And she's somebody that trains out of that old South Coast down there in BC. Squamish, the Sound Martial Arts. That's the same gym of one UFC fighter who's been in Jamie Lynn Horth's corner. Matt, who is it? Former bantamweight in the UFC, Cole Smith. Cole Smith.
There we go.
So a big corner there. But I mean, overall, all the amateur and pro experience for Jamie Lynn Horth has taken place at flyweight. So a big move up here. She's definitely the more dynamic striker out of these two. She's definitely the more adept when it comes to her submission attempts in her fights. But we'll see if that physicality comes into play for Haley Cowan. You look at the odds in the matchup, Matt. Cowan opened as about a 2-1 favorite. They're almost at par right now. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Haley Cowan.
I'll say under.
You're going to say under. And it's under. 488 total votes. 62% Horth. 52% by decision. 37% by submission. For the 38% that have Cowan, 85% by decision. And Matt, I mean, you talk about level ups in the game with the time away. Who knows what Jamie Lynn Horth's going to look like again with this much time off. She's kind of carried the same style throughout her fights, I will say that. But when you look at a matchup like this, what's the pick at bantamweight this weekend?
I don't know if at 33 we're looking at these big jumps in progress. This is what I will say, and I feel like we have been somewhat critical of Horth in this bit. I guess we've given both of them their flowers. But I think Horth has the slight edge in the matchup, even though I don't love her in a lot of matchups moving forward. And I hate to kind of leave it at that, but I think her striking is a little bit more complete, and I think that's what's going to edge her in a victory in this one.
I mean, Horth definitely has the better striking. Even if you go back to Haley Cowan's fight when she took on Middleton, at the end of it, Ron Crux talking about how Middleton's a forklift operator. She has been for 7 years.
Tough lady.
Yeah, she is. She drives a forklift for a living. Been doing that for 7 years.
So that level of competition necessarily hasn't been there. When you look at a matchup like this, I don't like the takedown defense of Jamie Lynn Horth. And I think that Haley Cowan's going to stick on her like glue. Although Cowan closes distance with hooks, head on the center line and kicks, which is troublesome against a volume striker with power like Horth has. I think Cowan's got enough to grind this one out, get a decision win, and move forward. So both of us split on the pick. Matt going with Canada's own Jamie Lynn Horth to get the win. I, surprisingly, third time out, going with Haley Cowan. Cowan Brennan in the matchup. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. 12 total fights as of now on this fight card. You're not going to want to miss it. So keep it locked in with Fighting Apex. We always say,
let's get into it.
In 2023, bantamweight is all the hotness. It's found in this main event. It's found last weekend with Patchy Mix knocking out Ralphion Stotts. And coming up this weekend, if you're not already excited about the bantamweight division, these two guys have 53 total combined fights, and 36 of them have ended before the final bell. They don't know a boring time. We have Boom Brian Kelleher taking on Journey Newson. And when you consider a matchup like this, Matt, Journey Newson, the run in the UFC, it's not been great.
No, and it hasn't been.
It's been very sporadic, but when it's gone really well, it's accentuated his styles. You look at the knockout win that he had over one tricky, tricky fighter that wasn't around for a long time, that's now considered a no contest on his record. That is against Domingo Pilarte. Got that done really early in the first round. His other win in the UFC over Fernie Garcia, a grinding type of decision where he's able to utilize his great wrestling. He threatened with a little bit of his jiu-jitsu. He got the hands moving as well. Complete performance there for Journey Newson. The losses are against some decent competition. We're talking Ricardo Ramos on about a week's notice. He replaced Sergio Pettis in that one. Randy Costa, where he got knocked out. And Sergey Morozov, where he got out-wrestled. It hasn't been, I guess, up to stuff. Now, all of a sudden, Journey Newson, you blink your eyes, and he's 34.
There's a world where Journey Newson could have become or had a career like Brian Kelleher. You know, just kind of stick around on the outside of the rankings. Maybe on your best day, kind of become the 16th guy. You know, because Brian Kelleher fought John Lineker at one point.
If Journey Newson wanted to be Brian Kelleher, he had to take his career like a Muay Thai career and fight every other weekend.
Exactly. Would have to be a lot more active. But they're like, when he showcases his skills, you don't look at Journey Newson and think, oh, he doesn't belong in the UFC, because he has really fast feet. He can close the distance exceptionally fast. He has good takedown attempts. He's a really good athlete. Like, he does check a lot of those boxes, but it really always has been putting the totality of his game together and finding success with that whole entire package. Because if he does wrestle a lot, he'll tend to get tired as the fights continue. He won't have the same pop on his punches that he does in the earlier goings of his fights. And he's a guy who, when he does start to gain confidence, he becomes a little bit too overzealous with his hands, and he will leave openings for his opponents to crack him with. And for Brian Kelleher, this is an interesting fight for him, because you had kind of alluded to it in the intro, like, this is kind of a lose and leave town kind of fight, and it very well could be, which is wild to think of, because Brian Kelleher was a pretty well-known commodity in the division for a really long time, and it's not like his last two losses have been to bad fighters by any means, but he does not occupy the same spot that he once did inside the division.
Go ahead.
He's not the guy who it's, hey, we have an up-and-coming prospect, we think very highly of them, hey, they should fight Brian Kelleher, because he is that great stepping stone to kind of becoming relevant in the division. I do worry about him with sort of the hand speed of Journey Newson, because Brian Kelleher still has surprising pop on his shots, but we've seen him get hit a lot throughout that career of his, and that's the thing. Journey Newson hasn't been as active, which means he hasn't taken the shots that a guy like Kelleher has, and I do worry about Kelleher and if those miles are starting to really gain on him.
Yeah, I mean, Kelleher's 8-7 in the UFC. He's picked up a litany of bonuses. He's got performance of the night bonuses against Ode Osborne, Alcantara, and Rodriguez. He's got two fight of the nights against Azure and Stasiak. And if you consider for Brian Kelleher, the last time that he went on a two-fight losing streak was back in 2018 against John Lineker and Montel Jackson. Some pretty darn good fighters, if you ask me. But even in the last two fights, Matt, we're talking about Umar Nurmagomedov, who's ranked number 11th in the bantamweight division, and Mario Bautista, who kind of occupies that like number 16, 17 ranked bantamweight at this point. So for Kelleher, it's a big step down. For Newsom to go from Morozov to Kelleher, it feels like kind of a lateral move, or maybe even a jump up a little bit. But when you do look at both of these guys, like some of the notes that I had for a guy in Journey Newsom, well, they have a former common opponent, and that's Ricky Simone. Well, I mean, it didn't work out for Journey Newsom. That was for a Rumble at Roseland title back in the amateur days, where Brian Kelleher loses to Simone in the UFC. And when you consider it and you look at a guy like Brian Kelleher, what does he do so well? And I've compared him for a long time to a guy like Georgie Karahanyan, both in stature, but the fact that they like to throw hooks to close the distance. They like to go guillotine to really stifle your wrestling. And they both have very, very good guillotines. And Brian Kelleher likes to take the daisy, pop the head off, and win his fight. So when you look at a matchup like this, I don't know, and this is the question that I have about the fight before I hand it off, if Journey Houston's going to be able to go out there and out-wrestle Brian Kelleher for large moments of this fight, because I could see that happening. Brian Kelleher has takedown defense in the form of submissions, and sometimes it can open up his own scrambles, but in a fight like this, it could have him held down for portions of the fight. Or will the power striking of a guy like Kelleher really win out in some of these exchanges against a guy like Newson, especially with Kelleher being out for quite some time since his last fight against Mario Bautista?
Which is kind of surprising, because for the most part, Brian Kelleher seems to fight like every 3 or 4 weeks. It has been a wild run for him. And you bring up 8-7 in the UFC, like, it's been a memorable run for him. It's not like Brian Kelleher, you're just going to forget about him in the UFC.
I like the parts of his game, but it is hard for a guy like Brian Kelleher to go in there and win a decision against a lot of guys. Now, I'm not saying Newsom's some guy who's a consistency king by any means, but Kelleher will go out there, try to throw a big explosion, and then kind of wait. He can be held down, and that's the thing I do worry about in this matchup. If he's not able to connect on one of those Hail Mary submissions, and we shouldn't even really call them Hail Mary submissions because he's able to do them so often. So if Kelleher's not able to really threaten with those submissions, I could see Newsom just going back and back to the well and going for a lot of takedown attempts in this fight.
We'll see if the former Cage Sport and Prime Fighting bantamweight champ Journey Newsom can get it done. He is the underdog in the matchup. Brian Kelleher about a minus 190. Journey Newsom at a plus 165. We have a look at the Tapology votes. They're a surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Kelleher in this one.
I think they'll be over.
I think the fans have him in this one, and they do. 544 total votes, 84% Kelleher, 76% by decision for the 16% that have Newsom, 65% by decision. To me, Newsom's continually progressed with his striking. We've seen that throughout his tenure, not just in the UFC, but as a pro. When it comes to a matchup like this, to me, it just depends. Has Brian Kelleher slowed down a ton at this point in his career with this many miles at this age? Kind of like we saw Bobby Green in his last fight against Jared Gordon. He looked slow. But when it comes down to this matchup, I'll still edge Kelleher in the fight. I think the strikes are there, and I do actually like that defensive jiu-jitsu on those takedown attempts.
I do, and I agree with you on the prediction. I do have Kelleher, but I worry about him getting held down in this matchup. I really do. If Newsom can disguise his strikes with his takedown attempts, it's going to make them a lot more readily available, and then if he can just waste time on top, for lack of a better term, he should be able to win this fight by decision. So I think he is a bit of a live dog, but I do have Kelleher in this fight because Newsom's not the most durable guy in the world. That's the thing. And Kelleher does have surprising punching power. So if he is able to start to get to Newsom, I could see him winning by finish.
Ground control time in 2023. It scores for a lot coming up this weekend. Both of us going with boom, Brian Kelleher. 12 total fights on the card. You are not going to want to miss them because in the main event, Sung Yedong's taking on the aforementioned Ricky Simone. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
This weekend's
why?
Fight coming up in the UFC, if you can believe it, a five-fight UFC vet and former ADCC European champ. It's Switzerland's Stephanie Egger. She's going to be taking on Russian Ronda Irina Alexeva. And Matt, when I went down through this one, I have no idea why this is even a UFC fight. Because if you look at it, for Irina Alexeva, I mean, there's articles out there. She signed with Invicta. Then she signed with Bellator. She had a fight. Then she got released by Bellator. The UFC scooped her up. They signed her back in August of last year. So they went with a 4-1 fighter. And we're going to bring up her record. I'm going to show it to the folks out there on Topology. She is 4-1 now.
You mean scooped her up in like a Rule 5 draft kind of sense?
Yeah, we're going to see if this prospect works out. And if they can't kick it on the 40-man, we're sending them back over to their original team. But when you look at the overall record, Matt, the accolades, they precede her. They are good, and they will kind of really hit you off the hop. But so you look at it for Irina Alexeva. She beats Guinara Gareva, and that's by refusal to fight. That's by refusal to fight. The next fight against Shakira Rakhimonova by decision. That's against an 0-2 fighter. Then she fights Zetia Shaftor at RCC 6 back in 2019. First round armbar against a fighter that's 5-5. She goes up against...
5-5 when you're 2-0, though, isn't terrible.
She goes up against Lilia Kazak, who had five times more experience than her. She was 8-6-2. And in that one, she gets out-punched. She gets out-grappled. She struggled against a fighter who she seemed to have a size advantage over. Even though at the start of the fight, she looked like she was going to finish Kazak. She kind of blew it in the first round, second round, third round, did not go her way. And then she took on Bellator's Stephanie Page, who was 5-2 back in 2021, wins that fight by decision. She weighed 129.9 pounds for flyweight, and the entire fight, the commentary team said, I don't know why she didn't make the weight. Boy, she looks really slow in this third round. Boy, it wasn't going very well. So again, I know I seem incredibly negative off the hop about this prospect who's 4-1, who's almost 33 years old. It's a really, really strange signing.
It is, but at least let me play devil's advocate for 2 seconds. We're not going to see her in the areas she's worst at in a lot of this fight. At least that's not what I think. I don't think Stephanie Yeager is all of a sudden going to go out there and start striking like Stephen Wonderboy Thompson and stay on the outside and really be able to avoid grappling for 100% of this fight. And that's why hopefully the grappling exchanges will be interesting, because of course we know how talented of an MMA grappler Stephanie Yeager definitely is at this point and throughout her UFC run. So for Arena, if she is able to translate some of that judo success over into the UFC, then I don't think this is going to make for the worst fight ever. I do agree with you. If you stack all of her skills up on top of each other, are they going to equal this crazy high tower? No, but whoa, I do think we will see the highest accentuation of her skill set.
Yeah, so for Irina Alexeeva, let's give her flowers. A three-time Russian judo champion silver medalist. She's a Russian and European gold medalist at the Sambo World Championships. A four-time Russian hand-to-hand combat champ. A two-time European hand-to-hand combat champ. A world champ in hand-to-hand combat. And if you do consider that, I read that from an article in 2019. It was a Sherdog one by Elena Katereskaya. So Elena putting in the work. But when you do look at it overall, for Alexeeva, she trains out of Ratty Team, which is also known as Ratty Borets, which is a gym that you're going to find Roman Kopylov out of, as well as Oleg Olenikov. But if I do look at Alexeeva, she will kind of strike to clinch. She throws massive looping hooks with her head completely out on the center line. She
leaves herself defenseless.
She is there to get hit. And wild looping striker, no jab, was another part of my notes in watching these fights. But when I considered it for Alexeeva, she started her career at featherweight. She moved it down to flyweight. She missed flyweight. Now we're up at bantamweight. And the last time that she fought was 553 days ago. And that's not saying that Stephanie Yeager is some peach. I know she's 5-3 in the UFC. Came in on short notice to take on Tracy Cortez. Got out wrestled. The other loss is to Maeda Bueno Silva. It was a phantom tap. But the other three fights, big wins. Jessica Rose Clark, performance bonus. She beats Eileen Perez in those wrestling grappling exchanges. And Shanna Young looked good with the striking to start. And then by the end of it, it was Yeager on top, landing a lot of that ground and pound. So when you do consider it for both of these fighters, Yeager will fight behind a jab, but she too will kind of follow it with her head. And she follows the path. Neither fighter's all that adept at cutting off the cage. Alexeeva has the wider breadth of strikes when it comes to both of these ladies and hits much harder, even though
because she puts everything into it.
We're not seeing a lot of finishes by knockout. Matt, well, when it does come down to this fight, we'll see Alexeeva making that walk into the UFC, making that debut in Vegas. The odds in this one, Yeager is a massive favorite. You have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under 72.5% Yeager, even though she's a big favorite.
I think they'll be over.
Yeah, they're over. So 470 almost total votes, 85% Yeager, 57% by submission for the 15% that have Alexeeva, 62% by decision. I mean, Stephanie Yeager, we haven't really talked about her. Like, she was somebody, took on Gabby Garcia at ADCC, wasn't necessarily able to get it done in that one, lost by points. She beat King Reyna over with Ryzen. That was kind of the coming out party win that she did have. But when you consider this, Matt, I mean, for Yeager, it's just got to be a lot of control positions in a fight like this.
This is the only thing about Yeager that I don't love throughout her UFC tenure. The two fighters she lost to are half decent, and the three fighters she's beat, they're not the greatest fighters in the world. Like, Shayna Young is extremely one-dimensional. Jessica Rose Clark, I thought, was going to beat her, but really she only has wrestling and not that much else, and she's not really in her prime anymore. Like, for Yeager, she's still kind of fighting the same level of opposition that she was when she came into the UFC. So if she wins this, it will be nice to see her really take a meaningful step up afterwards. I do have her in this fight, but that's just sort of a broader term on Yeager. It'd be nice to see her kind of take that step up and fight someone either who is either ranked or close to being ranked.
Alexeeva in the third round of her fight against Paige, the commentary team with Bellator said one of the strangest things I've ever heard.
It was just dragging that front foot. That's what you don't see. You know, you don't see the morning after. That's not on pay-per-view.
No, but it definitely is painful.
In the morning after, nobody gets to see that part on pay-per-view. Alexeeva, that fight against Kazakh in the second round, wobbles her, drops her, and then by the end of the round, Kazakh was going for a rear naked choke that looked like it was completely in. I don't know how Alexeeva didn't go out. So again, with that grappling defense that we've seen in some of these fights, maybe Alexeeva is able to pull it out in this one. She is the better striker on paper, but we'll see if that striking defense costs her in this matchup. I'm going to go with Stephanie Yeager in the fight. I think the judo and the jiu-jitsu might be just turned up a little bit, but we'll see if we get a little bit of a regression to the mean for Ole Egger. Both of us going with Switzerland's own in the matchup. Originally supposed to be two Swiss fighters on the card. Ange Lusa is out. Trey Waters is in, and he's taking on Josh Quinlan. That's just one of the matchups you got to look forward to. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Across the wire on Friday night, out is Switzerland's Ange Lusa. And then all of a sudden, Saturday night, it might have been buried out there, but you had the tweet from Big Marcel 24, Marcel Dorf, saying that in is the very recent, I'm talking 2 weeks hot off the press recent, LFA welterweight champ Trey Waters set to make his UFC debut against Vanderlei Silva's gym guy. We're talking about Bushido, Josh Quinlan. And Matt, when it comes down to this matchup, Josh Quinlan, we said before his UFC debut, man, this guy can crack.
He bangs.
Struggles with the takedown defense. And what happened in his first fight in the UFC? Struggled with the takedown defense, popped up to his feet, left hook, knocked out Jason Witt cold, sent him outside of the UFC. Thank you very much. So for Josh Quinlan, he made a UFC debut to remember. And this is a guy that, listen, he got the win over on Contender Series back in 2021 to Josh Quinlan. He struggled with some different USADA issues. So it is what it is. But Quinlan struggled with that after Dana White's Contender Series. Then he was supposed to take on Jason Witt. And that fight had to be moved. So it was originally scheduled for Vegas, then it got moved to California because of the DHCMT, the old metabolites there. So similar to the John Jones situation. So they move Quinlan from Vegas to California, and then he gets the win over Jason Witt about a week later. So now Quinlan gets this turn where he was originally supposed to be taking on 5'10", volume striking Ange Lusa out of Killcliff FC in a fight that would have been competitive.
That would have been a really fun fight.
Yeah, volume from the outside of Lusa to can Quinlan throw his kicks and his power shots and close that distance, to now all of a sudden 5'10", to 6'5", Trey Waters, who doesn't hold his hands up near his head like Ange Lusa, doesn't strike on the outside like Ange Lusa, and doesn't really have the same skill set whatsoever. And you might know Trey Waters from Contender Series this past summer. He was undefeated. He was taking on Gabriel Bonfim,
who's no scrub by any means.
Yeah, like he was landing decent shots and kind of frustrating Bonfim. Bonfim goes double leg. Waters grabs the guillotine, holds on for too long. Von Flew choke for Gabriel Bonfim, who was the LFA welterweight champ. So then Waters goes back to the LFA. He goes out there against a really, really tricky fighter, and it was a fun fight to rewatch.
Again, a week and a half ago.
Yeah, against Jalen Fuller back on the 14th of April. And in that fight, Fuller wins round one. Fuller's winning round two. And then all of a sudden, we have a straight left from Fuller because he's a southpaw. And then a right cross from Waters that lands on top and it drops Fuller like a sack of bricks. And it is all over. Second round knockout for Waters. So again, I know we know Trey Waters and the Fight Night Picks fans might know him from Contender Series, but this is a really interesting matchup all of a sudden.
Oh, 100%. This is the weird thing about Josh Quinlan. Is he just another, like, Chaos Williams? Like, how far can having, not a basic skill set, but having insane power, making guys really pay for getting close to you, but not really being able to have sort of the takedown defense and the overall volume to sort of match the rest of their games? I really like what I've seen out of Josh Quinlan. I was extremely impressed by that Jason Witt knockout. Like, that was one of the nicest knockouts you'll ever see.
And Witt's one of those guys. If somebody's going to take you down in the welterweight division, it's going to be Jason Witt. We saw that against Barbarino.
And if you're going to knock out anyone in the welterweight division, it's also probably Witt. But it will be interesting to see with how does Trey Waters deal with some of the rushes that Quinlan's going to bring in, because Quinlan's a guy who likes to get settled at space and then rush in, whereas Waters is kind of weird. He's big for the division. He will have success up close. He does have a really good clinch, a really offensive clinch too,
which is weird for such a long guy.
But again, we've been talking about this a lot, I feel like, because Ignacio Bahamondes wasn't that long ago, and I think there was another fighter recently who they kind of fit that archetype of, hey, we're really big, we're very rangy, but we get a lot of our work done up close. And that's the thing about Waters. That might not be his best path to victory in this matchup, because if he is far away from a guy like Quinlan, you're going to avoid some of the major implications that you'll face if you do start eating some of his shots. But if you can maintain your range and sort of avoid the big shots, I think Waters could have success. I don't know how he's going to deal with some of those rushes of Quinlan if it's not with his grappling or with some big power shot down the middle.
And I mean, both of these guys, if you're looking for a high level fight out of a debut fighter and a guy that's had one fight in the UFC. Quinlan was 6-0 as an amateur, 6-0 with the no contest being that Contender Series win where it was Drostenolone that caused him the issues, and that's why it's a no contest. It was a first-round knockout. For Quinlan, so well-schooled against a decent level of competition. For Trey Waters, 7-2 with a no contest as an amateur, and already as a pro, he's 7-1. Lose that fight to Bonfim, but for Waters, the only trouble is a pro. Level competition combined opponent record before Bonfim was 13-19-1, so it wasn't necessarily there. He winds up on a lot of his punches. He has really low hands. Like, if you saw Bobby Green last weekend, Trey Waters fits that type of... He keeps his hands either chest tight, down by his sides, or he does a Philly shell. And for Waters, he just utilizes a lot of core movement, and he moves his head quite a bit. And we haven't necessarily seen him caught in many of these fights. His takedown defense is good because he's so long up against the cage. But when you look at it for a guy like Waters, I mean, his fight against Ramirez, where he gets a submission win, his fight against Benjamin Bennett, where, again, we talked about it at the start of the show, it took one knee for Patchy Mix. That one knee from Trey Waters against Benjamin Bennett, and he was completely out. And then the fight against Jalen Fuller. Lost the first round, was losing the second round, and all of a sudden it was like Dan Hardy, Carlos Condit, who's going to fall first? And it was Waters who landed that crossover, the straight punch of a guy like Fuller. But going back and looking at it, Matt, I mean, Josh Quinlan coming from the one MMA fight team, one fight team MMA. And if you look at it for Trey Waters, he actually had Obi-Wan Kenobi the pillow, Stephen Coslow in his corner on Contender Series. He trains out of Elevate MMA. That's Preston Parsons' gym. So you're going to get some of the pummeling. You're going to get some of that grappling in. But he also trains out of Fusion XL. And I'm going to throw it up there right now. He was training with, I mean, you're going to have Philly Fresh there for sure. Phil Rowe, Gerald Meerschaert's been training out of there. But Lyoto Machida. He's been training with Lyoto Machida to get ready for Jalen Fuller. Maybe that's where you got that counter shot. Matt, when we look at this fight, no odds on it because it just came out on Saturday night. No Topology votes. Trey Waters, again, just fought about 2 weeks ago, so he's taking this one on short notice. But credit to him because
100%.
He's a very good fighter, as is Gabriel Bonfim, who beat him. So I'm glad to see Trey Waters in the UFC. It's just going to be interesting to me because where Waters throws those big looping shots, we could get into a bit of a firefight. And I think there's two big X factors for both guys. For Trey Waters, you talk about flexible hips for a long guy. He gets those legs up there really quick for some of those head kicks. For Josh Quinlan, man, his leg kicks are snappy, and he puts every fiber of his being into them.
No, and I'm glad you brought up the leg kicks. I was just about to. If he is able to use the leg kicks and slow down the movement of Waters, Waters is going to have a hard time, I think. Waters is a good striker at range when guys are trying to walk in on him. He does have that kind of sniper-like ability to catch them as they're moving in range. But if it limits his movement because he has eaten a lot of leg kicks, and if he's just trying to avoid some of the big shots of Josh Quinlan, I think at a certain point he's going to zig when he should zag and probably eat a big hook. So I think it's a really volatile fight because Waters does have so much power himself. He's kind of a tall, thin guy, but if you get hit by him, you are going to get knocked out. I just slightly do favor Quinlan in this fight.
Yeah, I mean, Waters moves so well in the octagon, utilizes that space. I mean, he's 0-1 in the Apex, whereas Josh Quinlan's 1-0, but it's a no contest. And when you look at a guy like Quinlan, even in his fight against Jennings, I went back and rewatched that one. And Michael Chiesa, I think it's in the second round, he goes, Quinlan looks so rigid and stiff. And then he goes on to say it's not a bad thing. But I wonder if the octagon jitters, if everything's kind of set aside, if Quinlan's able to really flow out there. Because when he does, he's such a good striker. And out of it, 12 of his 13 wins, pro and amateur, have ended by finish. 8 of 12 in the first round. I have Josh Quinlan in the matchup. We'll see how that length and size plays a factor. Exactly. Now going from a much shorter, more compact Ange Lusa to a bigger Trey Waters. You let us know down below in the comments section. If there's any fight that we need your help on, this is definitely it. So let us know down below who you have in the matchup. Some big fights left on this card. Song Yanong taking on Ricky Simone in that main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Flyweights meet in the small cage of the UFC's Apex. Coming up this weekend, a couple of guys who like to motor mouth. We have Cody Durden take on Energy Charles Johnson. And Matt, it seems like a collision course that we finally have this fight. And for Charles Johnson, his third fight in 4 months, the guy doesn't stop.
Active.
So when you have a look at the matchup, Matt, I mean, for Cody Durden inside of the UFC's octagon, he's done more winning than he has done losing. And the 5-on-in, he lost to Jimmy Flick. So MMA math fans are going to say, well, he lost to Jimmy Flick by finish, and Charles Johnson finished Jimmy Flick. So, of course, Charles Johnson wins the fight. But Johnson's last time out against Ode Osborne, my good grief, He was on the back foot for a lot of it.
He was.
And listen, a lot of people that were out there on the Twitter sphere thought that Charles Johnson won the fight. On MMA decisions, more thought that Osborne had won it than Johnson. But if you look at it, I mean, it's like that Chris Stapleton song. Nobody to blame but me. And Johnson had a lot of opportunities to capitalize on that fight and didn't necessarily do it. So when you look at a matchup like this, I mean, Cody Durden's one of those guys. And I'm going to bring in the prop now. I got a record. It's Jay Giles Band. It's the Love Stinks record. There's a song on this one. Third one on side one, Taking You Down. And I think they're talking about a different kind of taking you down. But I think Cody Durden out of American Top Team, not probably Atlanta anymore. ATT proper with a guy like Tony Gravely to train with, who used to train at ATT Atlanta. I think those boys are cooking up a takedown heavy game plan. I think that's going to be what Cody Durden's going to do.
He could strike with Charles Johnson. He could.
It'd be power versus volume.
Exactly. It would not favor Cody Durden in the slightest. Now, yes, he could land a big shot because he does have some decent looping shots when he is trying to close the distance, but he's not a guy like Marvin Vettori who's going to pump out the jab and really work combinations before the takedown. And Charles Johnson, here's the weird thing about Johnson. I feel like we only bring up the negatives in his game because the positives, they are, like, they speak for themselves when you watch him fight, but it's always him kind of holding him back because the volume is absurd. He's able to land really clean shots. He has good boxing combinations. He can strike moving backwards, even though in the last fight didn't really work, but still, not a lot of guys can throw volume strikes on the back foot, but Charles Johnson has that X factor in his game.
Moves his head and his core while he's doing it.
Exactly.
With his feet.
He does have a high-level boxing game, but the problem is, if he gets held up against the cage, it will eliminate a lot of that movement. It will prevent him from really being able to use that core movement as well, because you can't move backwards when there's a cage behind you. And it's going to help Cody Durden just center him a lot more and be able to cut the cage off. Because if Durden is able to have success in this matchup, it's because of his cage cutting ability. And that will be at the forefront of his game in this. Because if Johnson's able to just circle on the outside, pump the jab out, it's wild I'm going to say this, but he could Caitlin Chookagian himself to a win in this fight. He's going to be able to have those types of volume numbers by the time this fight is over. But Durden, I think, does have not just the wrestling X factor, but the ability to land power shots off the wrestling. So I'll be curious to see what Johnson does do if the takedowns are starting to get to him, if he's not able to use the movement as much as he's probably going to like.
And it was weird. Like, I listened to an interview that Charles Johnson just did with the All-Star MMA and JHK, and in that one, he said that he took the fight against Ode Osborne on 13 days notice. And then the quotable from the entire interview that I got, he said, and I quote, I did just get out of the Jimmy Flick fight. I feel good. My hand's still broken. Feel good. It's a boxer's fracture. And then he holds up his right hand. So I don't know if that's a recurring type of injury. We saw Kevin Holland break his right hand in three places.
Yeah.
And then when he fought Santiago Ponzinibbio, didn't throw his right hand until he threw a back fist and knocked out Ponzinibbio. So I don't know if Johnson carried that into the Osborne fight, and that's why he struggled. But by the jumping jeepers, Charles Johnson told a 10-minute story of how the Durden fight didn't come to be back in January. And then he spoke uninterrupted for 15 minutes. I've never seen an MMA fighter talk more than Charles Johnson. Credit to him. He weaved a good story. But I was captivated. But it lasted a really long time. But when you do consider it, he said coming into the Osborne fight, he had a sinus infection. He was dealing with the hand thing. He was dealing with the fact that it's a 30-hour trip from Thailand back over to Vegas. So all those things came into a bit of a perfect storm. Now, he did weigh 130 pounds last time out. You see that on the graphic, but it was a catchweight fight because of the short notice nature. So we'll see how Johnson makes out with this one, training in the States for this one. I know Tiger Muay Thai is listed as his gym in certain spots. It's Murcielago MMA for this one. But when you look at it for Johnson, he did win a Tiger Muay Thai scholarship some years ago. So he's competed out of that gym in the past. He also had a 1-5-4 boxing record, which is at the forefront of his game. But when you consider it for Johnson, we talked about it with Haley Cowan Brennan, the acrobatics and tumbling background. For Charles Johnson, track and field and steeplechase, and he was a two-time champ over there doing those disciplines. So for Charles Johnson, cardio is a big thing. We've always called him a five-round fighter. So we'll see how that plays out against Durden in the smaller cage, where Durden's a control, pressure-oriented wrestler, and he's been able to do that in a lot of his fights. And for both of these guys, I touched on it. Johnson beat Flick. Durden lost to Flick by finish. Johnson beat Moda over with, good old LFA, keeping that belt. Durden beat Modus last time out, 30-27, 229-28, 12 minutes and 32 seconds of control time, and then Moda pissed as hot as you can piss for a banned substance.
Yeah.
2-year USADA suspension for Meldonium. And I looked at Meldonium. That's an Eastern European type of compound there. So Johnson in the matchup, Matt, more than a 2-1 favorite. We look at the topology vote. Surprise us there to you. I think they're going to be closer. I'm going to say over under 67.5% Johnson.
I think they'll be under.
You think they're going to be under?
No.
They're over. So 545 total votes, 72% Johnson, 81% by decision for the 28% that have Durden, 82% by decision. So who do you have here?
If Durden wins, I think it will be one-way traffic. Like, I could see another fight where he gets 10, 11, 12 minutes of control time, looks really dominant with his wrestling, and if he is going to win this fight, that's probably how he's going to do it. But I do have Charles Johnson. I know there's a lot of negatives in his game, but I still like him with the volume, and I do think this fight's probably going to go to decision. I don't really think either guy has enough power edge over the other to really be able to get a finish on the feet. I think Johnson just is the much more complete guy on the feet, though, and for those reasons, I have Charles Johnson.
I don't like Durden in the third round at all. No. I mean, if you go back and watch his fight against Arichi Long, like, he got pounded off on a nearly finish at the end of that one. He really kind of blows that load early, and he comes hot. He comes hot in these fights.
Where,
man,
is your mind during these videos?
When you look at a guy like Charles Johnson, he get really together, comes Craig. On stronger as the fights go on. You gotta keep it clean. And when you look at a guy like Johnson, he's able to keep that motor going as these fights go late. But the thing that I struggle with for Johnson is the last three fights have been in the UFC's apex. He fought Jalga Shumagulov. He then fights Jimmy Flick. He then, his last time out, fights Ode Osborne. I thought he lost to Shumagulov. He finished Flick. And then he was the losing end of the fight against Ode Osborne. I think Cody Durden's going to have so much success with his wrestling in this fight. Charles Johnson thrives out of the wrestling scrambles, but he also tends to get held down. He struggled with wrestling defense when he was on the LFA scene. He struggled with it in the UFC, and I know that's been against Makhachev, and he struggled up against the cage against a guy like Jalga Shumagulov. I think Durden, his wrestling's better than Shumagulov. His striking's not, but I think that Durden's going to be able to capitalize on that. For that reason, I'm actually going with a pretty big underdog in Durden.
I think you answered your own question, though. I agree with everything you've said, but since his cardio is so poor, I don't think that's a sustainable game plan for all 50 minutes. I agree with every single point you just brought up. But if he's having that much success with his wrestling, Charles Johnson doesn't just lay there like a whale on the beach. He's going to try to get back up to his feet. And I do favor him that much more with the cardio. So I agree with all those points you brought up. I just think if he's having that much success, it's just going to drain his gas tank that much faster.
Matt, we're splitting the pick. You've got Inner G Charles Johnson. I'm going with the ATL's own. We're talking about Cody Durden. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have on the matchup main event. Sun Yedong, Ricky Simone, you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Strikers in a clash of style. Coming up this weekend at lightweight, we have the karate and kung fu artist known as Lethal, Natan Levy, and he's going to be taking on Dead Game Pete Rodriguez. Matt, when you look at a matchup like this, you have the MMA Lab represented with Pete Rodriguez, and this is a guy that, I mean, coming into the UFC, a lot of question marks, a lot of really quick knockouts.
Oh, yeah.
He then takes on Jack Della Maddalena, who's all the hotness at welterweight, struggles with the jab and the pressure, ends up getting finished in that one. His last time out against Mike Jackson, my good grief, he dropped him twice. He finished him.
The difference.
Sent him outside of the UFC. 1-1 with an old contest was Mike Jackson, but when you look at a matchup like this, for Pete Rodriguez, I went down through it. Light heavyweight, middleweight, and welterweight experience. This is his first fight at lightweight. I know he's not the biggest guy in terms of stature, but obviously that is a talking point coming into this one. His first cut down to 155. And he's taking on Natan Levy, who, as I said, kung fu and karate is the base. But he's very similar to a fighter that we had on last weekend's card, where we talked about their striking and their grappling. Natan Levy billed as a striker, but by the jumpins, does he wrestling. Ever like to grapple? So in a matchup like this, I'm eager to see how Pete Rodriguez deals with that, because he closes distance very quickly, and he closes it with a lot of power. So I'm really eager to see how that translates for Rodriguez, and for Levy, does he really try and initiate the grappling from Jump Street against a guy that, I've never seen Pete Rodriguez grapple in a pro mixed martial arts contest, but if you're going to do it coming out of a gym that has Sean O'Malley, Benson Henderson, Casey Kenney, and the like, I would expect it to at least be schooled somewhat for Pete Rodriguez. But I've never seen it.
Exactly, and that's the problem. If you've never seen it, you can't just assume he has some great background. And for Rodriguez, he had great power at 170, so I assume that's going to translate down to 155. So if he does have just such incredible, mind-blowing power at 155, maybe he could find success with
that. He's the next Michael Chandler.
But without the wrestling or any of the grappling. And that's the thing about Levy. I don't love his striking, if I'm being honest, because he has become a bit of a striker wrestler to where the ranges just don't match up. He goes for takedowns from kind of far away. But I'll be really honest, I like the grappling version of him in this fight because I do think it's going to help him avoid the most dangerous part of Rodriguez's game, which are some of those boxing exchanges on the back foot where Levy just might not be 100% comfortable with when Rodriguez is throwing these insanely powerful shots by his head. So for Levy, we have seen him get touched up a little bit in some of his fights, so I worry about that. But Rodriguez, I just don't know if he has that next note to his game. And if Levy is able to go out there and just sort of throw hands enough to disguise his own takedown attempts, really implement the takedowns at the forefront of his game, I don't know how Rodriguez is going to make up for it. And unless Rodriguez does just have such incredible strength and power coming down from 170, I struggle to see how Rodriguez is going to build in this fight and be able to win it by either decision or kind of a late round finish.
Yeah, I mean, Pete Rodriguez only really finished people in the first round. So that's kind of been the story on Rodriguez. And even out of the wins currently, the five wins that he has, combined opponent record 10-8 with a no contest because it was Mike Jackson.
But they are super impressive when he is able to
win. Oh, yeah. His fight against Guzman, he runs across the cage, throws a flying knee, and knocks him out in the first, 15 seconds? So it is over really quick. And the progression that we saw out of Rodriguez from those fights where it was run across the cage with Icon, with Game Bread, to now in the UFC, even when he was fighting Mike Jackson, the commentary team noted it, and rightfully so. He's switching stances, he's mixing in his kicks, like he's looking like a much more complete striker, and we definitely got to see more of Rodriguez last time out. But when we're talking about Levy, last weekend you folks saw on the main card, for some reason, Yasmin Lucindo beating Brogan Walker. And Yasmin Lucindo in the UFC, she's a striker, but on the regional scene, she's a grappler. Natan Levy is a striker, but really he's been a grappler in the UFC. And against Rafa Garcia, Garcia's all the hotness right now. 29-28 across the board. Levy went for takedowns. Garcia went for takedowns. Garcia prevailed with that. I mean, against Money Mike Breeden in that one, a lot of takedowns by Natan Levy, but Breeden rallied in the third round, and in my opinion, Breeden won that third round. 9 of 16 on takedown attempts was Levy in the fight against Breeden for only 3 minutes and 39 seconds of control time. So a lot of takedowns trying to get the top pressure like Levy did in his fight on Contender Series against Shaheen Stevenson, and in that one, or Santana rather, he gets a submission win. And Levy, I mean, his last time out, he took on a somewhat similar fighter, because I'm talking about a brawler in Renato Valdez. And in that one, Levy struggled with the strikes in the first round.
He did, yeah.
Mightily, but he went for a lot of takedowns. He went 6 of 10 in that one. So we'll see how it plays out for Levy. But as I did with my hands, the way that he blocks in some of these punching exchanges where he just kind of stops, plants his feet, and blocks with his hands, that's not good against a power puncher. Pete Rodriguez, and we talked about it on this channel before, Matt, your favorite song by Roy Jones Jr., what is it?
Y'all Must Have Forgot.
Y'all Must Have Forgot. Who did he knock out with a body shot? Y'all Must Have Forgot.
Stop Virgil Hill with the body shot.
Exactly. Yeah. Pete Rodriguez dropped Mike Jackson's last time out with a right hook to the body.
It's Mike Jackson, though. Let's just
kidney
say that.
Side. You never see that, Matt. Natan Levy, almost a 3-1 favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 75% Levy.
I think they'll be over.
And they are over. 572 total votes, 79% Levy, 76% by decision. Unsurprisingly, the 21% that have Rodriguez to win, 80% by knockout. I don't know who's thinking Pete Rodriguez is going to win by decision. Matt, Pete Rodriguez, again, light heavyweight to middleweight. His last fight as an amateur was supposed to be on an LFA card against Sullivan Cawley. Arizona's hotness. Now, he did lose his last fight over the Bellator, but Sullivan Cawley is a very good light heavyweight. Pete Rodriguez, from 205 to 155. I mean, the transformation. Wow. That's all I can say. I do like Levy with the more complete game plan. If Rodriguez starches him in the first round, that's probably the hedge.
Oh, yeah.
That's probably the look. But for me, I'm going to go with Levy to kind of pull this into the deep waters.
He's just more well-rounded. Like, I don't
From what we've seen.
Yeah, I don't love the fact that, again, you bring up the striking defense. It is quite poor. I'm not a big fan of it. If he used the movement along with the weird blocking, then yes, it might be effective. But Rodriguez has a chance to win this by first round knockout, but the pick has to be Levy.
Both of us going with Lethal Natan Levy to get the win in the matchup. Let us know down below in the comment section who we have. Are you going Levy? Are you going Rodriguez? Some big matchups on this card. Song Yadong's taking on Ricky Simone. You are not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. And it's finally time for the long-awaited UFC debut of El Valiente, the Brave, Mexico's own Fernando Padilla, the former Fury FC champ. He got a win on Fury FC 46, looking for a fight. He was signed to the UFC, and that was back in 2021. Padilla now taking on one of those fringe-to-be-ranked type of fighters. 12-fight UFC vet in his third stint. It's Julian Arosa. And Matt, the reason I say that is because, and I'll throw the tweet up there, Julian Arosa, in his last fight, was a minus 165 favorite against Alex Caceres, who at the start of fight week was ranked 15th. But then 2 weeks prior, Jonathan Pierce had gotten a win, so they then put Pierce as number 15. They dropped Caceres from the rankings, and Matt, I mean, you talk about disguising your hands to throw the head kick. Alex Caceres with a knockout of the year contender against Julian Arosa. So now Arosa, like a guy on Sunday morning, picking up the pieces, walking home. He's got to get a win in this matchup, and Arosa's going from fighting a fringe top 15 fighter, the fringiest of fringe.
But okay, this is
to a debuting UFC fighter.
I understand what you're saying about Arosa, but I kind of disagree with it, and this is why. If you're like, I don't look at him as like the 16th or 17th ranked guy in the division. How I look at Julian Arosa is anybody in the division, he can offer a difficult fight to. He can also lose to anybody coming off Contender Series too. If you're ranked 16th in the division, you're probably not going to fall to that level, I don't think. Like, I don't think Caceres would lose to somebody coming off Contender Series. Just for Arosa, he has great cardio, he has good durability if he's able to get past that kind of initial hump, but like we've seen, it is wild to say that he has good durability because he has been finished on numerous occasions at this point. But it is, if you catch him cold, you can knock him out. But if he settles into the fight, it's going to be a really difficult fight for you. He's going to make it ugly. He can eat shots. He's got good volume. He has a really good skill set. Just Arosa is one of those weird fighters because for as good as he is offensively, those holes are still there defensively. So, and even when he is able to settle into a fight, he still does get hit. It's just he doesn't go down as often.
Julian Arosa is a really shifty fighter because he could be billed as a southpaw. And if you do consider it for both of these guys, the switching of the stances can happen. Now, Padilla primarily, like I'd say 90% of it from orthodox, but he's not opposed to switching it up. But when you look at a guy like Julian Arosa, similar to Trey Waters that's on this card and Bobby Green that was on last week's card, striking defense, a lot of head movement, hands very low, but those odd angle punches really set things up because it's hard to see what's coming. But let's throw it on over. I mean, you look at a guy like Fernando Padilla, he hasn't fought in a meaningful amount of time. He did an interview, and that's coming up with a guy that you guys know and love from MMA Sucka, James Lynch. And in that one, the question was, well, why is there such a layoff? And the quotable was, just the visa, really, to be real with you, just the visa issues. And other than that, he's been training for the last couple of years. And Padilla comes out of a great gym. We're talking about Team Oyama with some of the best in the world, former champ Carlos Esparza, Colin Oyama. We've seen him corner a lot of fighters in the UFC. But for Padilla, you look at all of the fights. He starts off his pro career back at 18 years old in Mexico in a co-main event slot of all things. And that was a card that was headlined, and one half of it was Jorge Gonzalez, you know, the guy that was supposed to be in the UFC, but he had a dirty USADA sussy. And Gonzalez just couldn't make the walk a few years ago. So when you look at it for a guy like Padilla, at such a young age, he was able to accrue a nice record. He fought a good level competition. He had a loss back to Dan Ige that was two fights before Ige was in the UFC. He had a win over Derek Minner where Minner was beating him and he took him down. And then all of a sudden, Padilla just pulls out a submission win and Minner's just like laid out on the canvas. It was just a crazy win over with the LFA. Padilla continues. He gets rolling. His last loss was to Spike Carlisle 4 years ago. He beats Nate Richardson by split decision. I went back and watched that. I thought that Padilla won that one. And then his last time out against Cameron Graves, it was like, listen, Padilla might struggle in this area, in that area. Padilla was walking him down, beating him soundly.
It's just like, Padilla could be a great fighter one day. Why are they making this his debut? Like, that's the weird thing about this. They're doing him no favors whatsoever by just throwing him into the deep waters against a guy like Arosa. Yes, he could win this fight by early knockout, but the problem is, if you beat Julian Arosa by early knockout, do you get an easy fight after? Not at all. They just get way more difficult. And if you lose to Julian Arosa, okay, it's not the end of the world, but...
Cut the difference. Why do you think Julian Arosa is going to win this fight?
I just think the overall volume, like, again, a guy coming off a long layoff who's young in his career fighting Julian Arosa. Arosa has those skills to where if he closes the distance, makes it really uncomfortable and throws that elite level volume, I don't think the takedown is going to be a big factor for Arosa. Again, he's not a real great grappler. He has great submission abilities, but he's not some D1 wrestler by any means. There's a lot of like loose single legs kind of from the clinch. I just think the wrestling and the overall kind of dirt, or not the wrestling, the striking and the overall kind of ugliness of Arosa's game. It's just a difficult game plan for any prospect with a long layoff to come in into the UFC against.
I think the southpaw to southpaw look in the matchup, the fact that Padilla is such a good counter striker, I think Padilla beats Julian Arosa in this fight.
No, I'm not disagreeing with that. And Padilla could go on and have some great career. My only point is, this is a weird fight for him, because if you beat Julian Arosa, which he very well could, you're just going to go on and fight monsters after that. And if you lose to Julian Arosa, then it's going to get rid of a lot of the shine. That's my only point.
And the really interesting thing about this fight, and Padilla's done a couple of different interviews leading up to this fight with some different people. He's touched on the fact that these two guys have drilled together, but they didn't train together. It was a few years ago, so they got some chances on the mat, but it really was a nothing burger. And when you look at a fight like this, Padilla struggled with the takedown defense in his prior fights. And if you look at it for Julian Arosa, he's kind of struggled with the overall concussive blows in a lot of these fights. He's been knocked down 8 times in 12 UFC fights, but in some of the car crashes, we saw that fight of the night, fight of the year contender against Steven Peterson, he was able to rack up volume numbers, land really good power strikes, and he didn't get finished. And like you said to start this video off, as these fights go on, it's almost like his brainstem gets stronger and he builds himself up in a lot of these ones. So we could see a very, very good fight between these two guys. The unknowns of Padilla with the long layoff, but the fact that he does come out with a really good game plan, really good kicks. He kicks to all three levels and he throws some really good counter strikes. But if Arosa is able to go out there, tick up some of the volume numbers, pick his power shots like we know that he can from those odd angles, Arosa is a good contender to get a win in a fight like this. He is almost a 2-1 favorite in the matchup. Topology votes, surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 80% Arosa.
No, I think they'll be under 80%.
I think they're going to be under. They're 90%. So 544 total votes, 90% going Arosa, 56% by decision, 29% by submission for the 10% that have Padilla, 54% by knockout. I have Padilla to get a win in this matchup. I think Padilla is going to win by decision in the fight, but we differ on that pick, and that's fine.
Yeah, I just find it odd that you're so confident in Padilla. I do have Arosa, though. Again, I just think the volume is going to be really difficult for Padilla to deal with, especially coming off a long layoff. I just think Julian Arosa is one of those guys where if you're coming off a layoff and you're trying to find your rhythm back in a fight, you don't want to fight Julian Arosa.
Two of the biggest guys you're ever going to find at featherweight at 6'1", and surprisingly, Julian Arosa doesn't have the reach advantage in the fight. We'll see how this one plays out. Split on the pick. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. The lower weight class is all the hotness. Bantamweight in the main event. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. The main card of this weekend's UFC Vegas 72, UFC Fight Night Song versus Simone. There's two unranked heavyweight contests. The first one is between Cuba Missouri's own, the prototype, former RFA middleweight champ, Jake Collier, taking on the former Octagon heavyweight champ, Martin Budai. And Matt, Martin Budai's start to his UFC career has been the most head-scratching thing I've ever seen. He has a unanimous decision win in his debut against Chris Barnett. Technical unanimous decision win because there were illegal strikes to the back of the head of Chris Barnett, and instead of a no contest or a disqualification, we went to the judges' scorecard.
The old Bisping Belcher.
Martin Budai was awarded the win. Then his last time out against Ukash Drevsky, he goes out there and he gets a decision win. Now, Matt, over on MMA decisions, one scored at 29-28 Budai, 11 scored at 29-28 Drevsky, one scored at 30-29 Drevsky, but Budai ends up getting the win. So all of a sudden, Budai goes from fighting Drevsky, who looked terrible his last time out against Carl Williams, to now Budai fights Jake Collier. And I had high hopes for Budai coming into the UFC. We compared him to, and I still think the comparison's valid, a non- herky-jerky Ben Rothwell. He walks forward, he puts his body weight on his opponents, he'll clinch you to drag your head down to try and tire you out. He's one of the bigger heavyweights you're going to find. You can see that from the graphic, 266. He has decent volume numbers on the outside. But I saw him, you know, before he came into Dana White's Contender Series against Kamel Minda, where he almost got finished in the first round. He looked super tired, and then in the second round lands one jab from distance that didn't look like it landed, and Minda's out on his feet and drops, and that's it. So for Budai, he looked good on Dana White's Contender Series. He looked all right against Chris Barnett, and then his last time out against Gravski looked very bad, whereas Jake Collier's had fights where I thought he won, but he lost against Carlos Felipe. I thought he won, but he lost against Andrei Arlovsky. And his last time against Chris Barnett, you talk about blowing loads. He blew that load.
I haven't talked about blowing loads one time, but you can't avoid bringing it up.
And
in
then
every video.
In the second round, Jake Collier was out of gas, and Barnett took over.
And that's what I don't like about Collier. Even though you can disagree with the decision in the Arlovsky fight or the Felipe fight, but the problem with Collier is when he initially went up to heavyweight, what I liked was he was a fast heavyweight, right? Physically, he looked like a heavyweight, but he still kind of fought like the middleweight version of himself. He had good volume, he had good footwork, he moved well for a heavyweight, but I feel like he has somewhat slowed down a little bit in these previous couple of fights.
I disagree. Like, I thought the Volante version, the Felipe version, the Arlovsky version, all three versions of Jake Collier in those fights, where I thought that he won all three of those fights, he looked quick and the volume was good and the leg kicks were really good.
Arlovsky's 40-some years old and well past his prime. I just think for Collier, it's one thing to look fast against those guys who, like Felipe's not especially fast either. I just think for Collier, the thing that was so special about him now that he is starting to even face upper levels of competition isn't as important as it once was. So I will be curious to see if Collier has enough power to hurt Budai, because you're right. Budai's a guy who really makes you feel his physicality, and it's not a perfect comp because Tyson Fury's so good, but that's what I always talk about with Fury, right? He makes guys feel him. He's really wearing on them with his shoulders. That's something Budai does do very well, and I think it will help him avoid some of those strikes of a guy like Jake Collier. So we'll be curious to see if Collier has enough kind of one-shot power to get the respect of Budai, because if he is able to do that, I could see a world where Collier is able to mix in the takedown, even just feint it, use the clinch, and be that well-rounded mixed martial artist that he is. I just worry that if he is on the back foot and he's not really able to gain the confidence or the respect of Budai at any point throughout the fight, Budai won't have any reason to not just continue to walk forward, kind of wear on Collier as this fight continues.
Yeah, it really is a strange one, and especially when you look at Jake Collier, his UFC record, not the shiniest. He had that great fight against Marcel Fortuna, where again, it was a lot of volume, it was a lot of the leg kicks, but by the numbers, if you do look at it for a guy like Jake Collier at heavyweight, 16 leg kicks against Volante, 24 against Felipe, 20 against Fortuna, it's numbers like Jay Sherman, who was able to go out there and submit, but it's numbers that kind of put that money in the bank to really pay off as these fights go on. And even for a guy like Budai against Lorenzo Hood, Budai was a minus 400 favorite in that fight, withstood some adversity before he ended up getting the finish, and now that 2-0 in the UFC, it's great, but it's almost like sitting in your car listening to We Will Rock You on cassette. If you're really good at drumming on your steering wheel, nobody cares. It's that same type of 2-0
that baking it.
It's great, but you're not really getting anywhere with it. So when you look at the odds in the matchup, Budai is a slight favorite, like ever so slightly. They're almost at par. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Matt, Martin Budai is 11-1. And Jake Collier's 13-8. I'm going to assume the fans have Budai in the fight.
Probably.
I'm going to say over under 69% Budai.
Where is your mind?
69%.
I'm going to say over.
I'm going to say over. It is over. 564 total votes, 87% Budai. 48% by decision, 44% by knockout. The 13% that have Collier, 68% by decision. Jake Collier throws really good volume, and if he gets Budai hurt, maybe just take your time, pick him apart like a Jeff Neal type. But when I look at it, I do have a hard time. The odds suggest a close fight. I have a hard time picking this fight.
It is a close fight because it's going to come down to the overall control and the dirty boxing of Budai versus how much work Collier can get done on some of those in-betweens. For that reason, I think Collier is a smart pick, even though I am going to go with Budai because I think this fight is so close. I just think the overall physicality will start to wear on Collier as this fight goes on. But again, if he can use the leg kick, evade some of those clinches and some of the dirty boxing of Budai, Collier has a great opportunity to win this fight. I just don't think he's going to be able to use the grappling as much. And for that reason, it's going to make him much more of a striker.
Collier's one of those guys in clinch situations where he automatically digs one underhook, gets the other lead hand behind the neck, tries to snap it, get out of the bad position. And if he can't snap it away, he tries to land really sneaky uppercuts when he is in those clinch positions. He lands better volume numbers than Martin Budai, but for the same reasons. All of a sudden, control time, it scores with judges. And in a heavyweight fight where I don't necessarily see a finish, I guess I'm going with Badass Martin Budai in this fight. Budai is one of those guys that closes range with a jab, doesn't check leg kicks that Jake Collier throws, which is a little scary. When he closes the distance, he really tries to knock it down and then go for his takedown and really wear on his opponent. So for those reasons, I'm going to go with Slovakia's own Martin Budai. One of a few Slovaks in the UFC, like Ludwig Klein, who's got a big fight coming up against Jim Miller. So that one's interesting. But both of us in the matchup going with Budai. If you have Jake Collier, you let us know down below in the comment section. Some big fights, including Waldo Cortez Acosta, Marcos Rogério de Lima. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fighting Apex, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Unranked heavyweights on the main card. Marcos Rogério de Lima, Pizarro, was last time out. Finished a former UFC heavyweight champ. Now he fights down the rankings a little bit against the DR's former Cincinnati Red prospect, Waldo Cortez Acosta. I'm talking Salsa Boy. And Salsa Boy, already 2-0 in the UFC. A tidy little run he's had. He beat Jared Vandera. He beat Chase Sherman. And now he gets to, again, fight up the ranks against Marcos Rogério de Lima. Now I'm going to get Canadian on you for a bit. Maple Syrup. It's about a 40-1 ratio of maple sap to then get maple syrup. Birch, Matt, and you handed me this handy prop. I got some birch beer, which you can get in Newfoundland, but apparently it's Scoop and Save in New Brunswick.
Shout out.
Birch beer takes about 120 to 1 ratio to get birch sap to birch syrup. So it's very difficult. But birch syrup, it's a tasty little treat. You can get that from black birch or yellow birch. We have yellow birch here.
Nobody who knows these fighters cares about this.
But black birch is in certain parts of the States. Why do I say that? Because the heavyweight division is diluted like birch syrup.
Okay.
And we get fights like this.
We could have much easier just said, remember that whole point I made on question mark kicks and really hammered home? Hey, the loser of Usman versus Taffa is going to fall to this thing we just call like the unranked cesspool of heavyweights, where it's like, look at the fighters Cortez Acosta's just fought. Jared Vandera, Chase Sherman. There's just like 10 heavyweights who keep on fighting each other outside of the rankings. And guess what's going to happen to the loser of this fight, Craig? They're going to join that big old pool. So maybe they're having a really fun time down there because it is just the same 11 fighters just sort of cannibalizing each other. None of them get cut because they all just go like 1-1-1 against each other. So that's positive. It's just, this is a strange fight because for Cortez Acosta, he was kind of hyped up coming off Contender Series. There were some positives. He has great boxing. He has good hand speed too. He moves well. He's late on his feet. But the problem is, De Lima's one of these guys who is very in sound and in tune with who he is. And that's what I like about Rogério de Lima. Even at 205 when he couldn't make the weight, and I don't even like saying he fought at 205, he fought at 210 at 205. But for de Lima, does he fight like a different version of himself at any stage of his career?
He fights like a banshee.
He does. He fights like a banshee.
Like he didn't put enough quarters in the parking meter.
I'm pulling on this hook of yours.
Let me pull it in. All right. Waldo Cortez Acosta, a great boxer. He's a very good boxer in MMA. As a pro boxer, he's 6-4.
I don't think he's three wins. Deontay Wilder tomorrow.
Three wins by knockout, 4 losses by knockout. Andre Ward in Waldo Cortez Acosta's last boxing match against Sonny Kanto, who's 11-0. Andre Ward said, and I quote, "Yeah, Cortez is a very awkward fighter. Former MMA fighter. He doesn't really have a style." Andre Ward.
They said Chris Norat didn't know what he was doing against Huey Fury, so they can get pretty mean sometimes.
We've
Craig.
Made a lot
I'm
of
saying.
Canadian and New Brunswick specific references in this video. Apologies to the MMA fans in the States, but when I look at a fight like this, Waldo Cortez Acosta, I mean, even in his LFA title fight that he did have just a few fights ago against Thomas Peterson, struggled with the takedowns. But once he got back up to his feet, he got the knockout win against Danilo Suzarchi. He wasn't much of a fighter. Cortez Acosta was a big favorite, knocked him out in that one. Against Jared Vandera, really close fight. Jared Vandera did a great job with the leg kicks, but Cortez Acosta did enough with his boxing volume to win it. And then against Chase Sherman forgot what Jared Vandera did, forgot what Chase Sherman was good at, and didn't throw leg kicks. And Waldo Cortez Acosta boxed his ears in.
Chase Sherman, did you think he was going to put on an MMA
when
IQ?
When Sherman won fights, his leg kicks were good. But when you look at a fight like this, Rogério de Lima, is he good at grappling? Yeah. Does he have good takedowns? Yeah. Did he starch Andre Arlovski's last time out? Yeah. Does he have really overwhelming striking?
Back on, is he good at grappling?
Striking abilities when he needs to? Yeah, he did against Ben Rothwell. He starched him. But against Blagoy Ivanov, oddly enough, Jerry Udalima stayed in it as that fight went on, and it was relatively close against a ranked opponent in Ivanov. So when I look at a matchup like this, Matt, can Waldo Cortez Acosta really threaten with, he likes to go jab to the body, up top, right hand. Can he put together some boxing combinations like that against a guy like Udalima, or does Berserker Udalima run across the cage and get a finish in this one? That really is the question, I guess.
It is. This is my problem with Udalima. Outside of some of those big bursts, I do think he is going to struggle if he isn't able to implement the leg kick effectively in this matchup, because he does throw a lot of these big looping shots from the outside, and if Cortez Acosta is able to still use his legs during this fight, he can pepper him with counter shots off the back foot. So I think the leg kicks will be an essential component in this for Udalima, but again, it just comes down to how effective is he going to be with the leg kicks and then with the flurries that follow those leg kicks, because I do think Cortez Acosta is going to have success on the feet throughout this fight. I think he does have the faster hands, and I could see him even having the higher volume numbers. Not saying that that means anything, because again, if he gets hit by huge shots, it won't matter, but I do think he will have success on the feet. It just comes down to how mobile can he maintain throughout this fight, because if his mobility starts to decline and if he becomes more available to be hit by Udalima, like Ben Rothwell went, what, like a decade without getting knocked out, and he got knocked out by Udalima. So even though Dalima's 37, he still does have incredible power.
And Dalima's record's weird in the UFC. He's 9-6 since he came in off the Ultimate Fighter Brazil Season 3, lost in the semifinals to Shoeface, the PFL champ, so millionaire. But when you look at it for Udalima, 9-6 in the UFC, 5 of those 6 losses are by submission. The other one is the decision of Blagoy Ivanov. 7 of his 9 wins are by finish, and all of those 7 finish wins are in the first round. So Udalima gets it done and gets it done quick. It's just, can Cortez Acosta follow an Ivanov game plan? And even in that fight, we talked about it with Budai. Ivanov wearing on that gas tank, really putting his body into it, making it boring. Cortez Acosta doesn't really fight like that. So you look at the odds. Udalima is a slight favorite in the fight. We have a look at the Tapology votes. I'm going to let you set them because I don't know where they're going to be, even though Dalima's favored in the fight.
I'll put him at 55% Udalima.
I'm going to say over. Then look at that. See, I didn't know. 567.
You're not used to it, Craig.
576 total votes. 59% Cortez Acosta, 49% by decision, 45% by knockout. For the 41% that have Udalima, 56% by knockout. So there's some that see a knockout out there. I would think if Udalima is going to win, it's probably by finish. But Cortez Acosta, probably a sharp look to continue to drag this one into deeper waters.
I have a hard time with this fight. I really do, because I think Cortez Acosta is going to have success until he doesn't. And that's a hard point to try to figure out in the fight, because if the point's at minute 16, well, we're never going to get to it, right? Cortez Acosta is just going to win this by decision. It'll look really good with some of his boxing combinations. But let's say he does start getting, like, dropped by leg kicks to where he's getting hit. He has to pick himself back up. Like, those are going to be effective enough shots for Udalima to where I think he will be able to throw those flurries. But maybe even against my better judgment, I'm going to go with the younger heavyweight between the two. The odds on underdog, but the fans seem to be going with him on Tapology. I'll go with Cortez Acosta.
It's just like last weekend's main event. You had Pavlovich, the fans had him, but he was the underdog. And if you look at it for Cortez Acosta, he was a minus 240 favorite his last time out, minus 195 against Vandera. Now all of a sudden he's the underdog. And Cortez Acosta, what I really, really liked out of his last fight was first round, feeling out process, but the second round, he landed 71 total significant strikes. 147 significant strikes in the fight. And when he's flowing with his boxing, he can just continue to land those volume numbers on the outside. I think power at heavyweight's a great equalizer. So for that reason, I have Marcos Rogério Udalima. But I'm really eager to see what the fans have in this one, because the odds and the fans and Tapology is just kind of all over the place. Yeah. So let us know down below in the comments section who you have. I mean, listen, the next fight, Cody Brundage, Rodolfo Vieira, a rematch or a rebooking, that's really, really just, it's a lot of fun. So you're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. A rebooking of a fight that was due last November, one where we picked the black belt hunter Rodolfo Vieira to get the win. We have Cody Brundage taking on Rodolfo Vieira. And for Brundage, he didn't take that fight against Vieira. Vieira withdrew. Brundage got into an odd situation with one half of the co-main event coming up this weekend. Lord Michael Olszczyk. Brundage runs across the cage, gets the takedown. Olszczyk back up to his feet. But no, that's not what happened, because Olszczyk reverse position and landed nasty ground and pound to the point where it looked like he put Brundage out, and you had Olszczyk getting the first round win. So what does Brundage do? Well, similar to last weekend's co-main event, he grows a beard like Bruno Silva, and he's back to his roots. So listen, if you grow a beard at middleweight, you get finishes, and we'll see if Brundage can do what he did in his last win against Treshawn Gore, knock him out with his boxing. Matt, Cody Brundage, a big opportunity against Rodolfo Vieira, and Brundage we've seen in some of these fights where, let's go, William Knight fight. Well, he's beating him with his grappling until they get back up to the feet and he gets finished. His fight against Olechechuk, he takes him down, but then he gets finished. His fight against Treshawn Gore, he boxes him, even though Brundage is a collegiate wrestler from Newberry College. Brundage has had these ups and downs throughout the time that he's been, not just in the UFC, in overall mixed martial arts. Rodolfo Vieira, what's his problem? It's cardio. His cardio is his problem. It got him caught against Fluffy Hernandez. It got him tired where he went 0 of 20 in takedown attempts against Chris Curtis. So we'll see if Vieira can go out there and get a finish in a matchup like this. But I'm really eager to see what we get because Brundage speed bump against Olechechuk, it's not really the same one that you're going to face against a guy like Vieira. And Vieira, I'm just eager to see what version we get as he ages and progresses. The 33-year-old, the former ADCC, like, we're talking like champ, not just like a European champ, Oceania champ. Vieira is that grappler, and he does have really good takedowns in his own right.
He does.
It should be a matchup and a clash where we get these two guys both in the middle.
It definitely should be, but there's a reason we both picked Rodolfo the last time around, and I still favor him in the matchup for these reasons. The majority of the time when Cody Brundage is having success, you brought it up, he is implementing the takedown, he is using his wrestling, and he has darn great wrestling. Who's the one guy at middleweight you probably don't want to use that wrestling against? Like, Rodolfo isn't just a good black belt on the ground. He's someone who can get reversals off of his back. He does have, like, a small man's jiu-jitsu game for being a big guy. It is kind of like Shoeface. A lot of guys, or people will forget him. Shoeface had legitimate jiu-jitsu, and even his isn't as good as Vieira's. So, for Rodolfo, if he's just facing a guy who's expecting to take him down a lot and going in there to implement his own takedowns, Rodolfo's probably, he's so happy. He's not going to go 0 for 20. He's going to enjoy getting taken down. Like, I understand Cody Brundage is a heavy fighter on top, has good ground and pound. It's not going to be an enjoyable experience for Rodolfo Vieira in this matchup, but it's going to make his job an awful lot easier, and that should help him in the cardio department in this matchup.
The weird thing for Brundage is, go back to his fight against Nick Maximov. Maximov only wrestles. He took down Brundage. Brundage landed better shots, but Maximov was credited with so much ground control time out of a poor takedown ratio. Brundage goes out there against, again, Treshawn Gore, a striker, and he knocks him out on the feet with his boxing. If Brundage can keep the striking, I definitely think he can beat Vieira. Vieira will pump a jab out there, throw those big looping shots, but I went back and looked at it, and the scorecards that Vieira had when he was taking on Dustin Stoyfus, that was tied going into the third round before he got that submission win. That was a performance bonus. And each of these guys out of their wins only have one win over guys that are still in the UFC. Brundage beat Gore, Vieira beat Stoyfus, but all the other guys aren't in the UFC. Piotta, Safarov, Lungiambula for Brundage, so no longer in the UFC. So it is a little chintzy that way. And again, for Vieira, if you look at it, four-time IBJJF World Champ, 2015 ADCC World Champ, 3-1 in grappling tournaments against the former Bellator middleweight champ, Rafael Lovato Jr. It's not Rafael, it's Rafael. So he's 3-1 there, lost the first one, won the next three. And if you've ever watched the grappling matches between Rodolfo Vieira and Marcus Almeida, go out and watch them. Almeida's the best, so they are a lot of fun to watch. But when you look at a matchup like this, again, Brundage is a better striker. Wild.
We don't want to see 15 minutes of him striking, though.
You don't, but you could. Vieira's about a 3-1 favorite. Don't like that. Vieira has good offensive wrestling, and I go back to it. His fight that he had coming into the UFC over with ACA, where he took on one Vitaly Nemchinov before he fought Piotta. He ran across the cage, got a double leg, and as Nemchinov turned, he was able to get the submission victory. I like that out of Vieira. I don't know how the takedown defense of Brundage is going to hold up against a guy like Vieira if we get into those long-winded grappling exchanges, but for Vieira to go 0 of 20 in takedown attempts against Chris Curtis, that is a little strange, I guess. So we look at the topology votes, Matt. Surprised us there to you. I'm going to say over under 77.5% Vieira.
Way over.
Because the odds are where they're at. Only slightly over. 566 total votes, 83% Vieira, 86% by submission. That's not the surprise. For the 17% that have Brundage, 44% by decision, 43% by knockout. Brundage, when he knocked out Treshawn Gore, was like, you know, going crazy. Like, you told me I can't box, you told me I can't do this, do that, whatever. His boxing did look really good, and it has improved. It has much improved. Bad boy beard Brundage, We'll see if that plays out in a matchup like this. I'm really eager to see it. I have Adolfo Vieira in the matchup. I still do. I had him back in November. That Brundage loss to Olaszczyk doesn't change anything in my mind. But I do like Vieira with the powerful grappling and the fact that maybe I did see Olaszczyk hit that reversal and land the ground a pound. I do like Vieira.
How good have Ultimate Fighter winners been lately? I don't put a lot of stock into the Trayshawn Gore fight. I have Adolfo Vieira in this matchup.
Both of us going with Vieira out of Fusion Excel to get the win. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have, Matt. The co-main event, Bohalio taking on Olaszczyk. You are not going to want to miss. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Win streaks are on the line for middleweights looking to crack the rankings. We have Kyle Bohalio in his third UFC co-main event, already four fights deep, or this will be his fourth. We're talking about the natural, and he's taking on Poland's Husar, Michael Olaszczyk. And for Olaszczyk, his last time out against Cody Brundage, he knocked him out in the first round. Got taken down, reversed it, got the knockout win. And if you look at it for Olaszczyk in the UFC, it's been a wild ride. Like, you remember his debut against Khalil Roundtree, where he looked amazing. You remember some of these wins that
what
he
has. What happened after that, though?
Yeah, I mean, it was a no contest.
Well, yeah, you saw it.
It was a no contest. But for Olaszczyk, a lot more wins than there are losses. He knocked out Sam Alvey before his last fight. He lost the decision to Dustin Jacoby. And if you want to go, hey, Olaszczyk's beaten grapplers, he beat Shamil Gamzatov, made him look human, ended that win streak, he was undefeated, knocked him out up against the cage. If you look at it for Bohalio in these three wins, it's a little weird, right? Like, he looked amazing on Contender Series, he had to fight twice over there, won two decisions. He goes out there and beats Gadzhiev Mrgadzhiev by technical decision, he beats Armin Petrosian by decision, grounds out the striker, and his last time out against Mahmoud Muradov. All right. So here in Fight Night Picks, we know that Bohalio is good at wrestling. He's good at jiu-jitsu. Definitely. He fights out of the Fighting Nerds. He's kind of one of the proto-coach grappler fighters out of that gym, if you will. But Kyle Bohalio has a long...
He's a spaceman, pizza delivery policeman. Like, he just does everything.
Yeah, he kind of fights on the feet. He mimics Lyoto Machida on the feet. Long, rangy, southpaw striker. Yeah. And this is southpaw versus southpaw matchup. He did that for most of the first round against Mahmoud Muradov and had some success with his kicks. And Muradov didn't open up with his boxing because of the threat of the takedown. Now, that was a wild fight where majority scored at 30-27 Bohalio. There were some 29-28s out there. But it was an evolution of Bohalio's game. It was nice to see for sure. But boys, oh boys, I don't think that's going to fly against Lord Michael and those body shots from that southpaw stance. And I've said southpaw twice because this is southpaw against southpaw. So it opens up the threat of the body strikes for a guy like Olaszczyk. It then accentuates the striker style out of southpaw. Olaszczyk gains ground in a matchup like this.
I'm going to be honest. I think this is a terrible matchup for Olaszczyk. And I'll say why. He gets taken down in every single fight. And yes, he was able to scramble to his feet in the Brundage matchup the last time out. But he still got taken down. And that's my issue. Olaszczyk is still always a liability takedown defense-wise. Yes, he is a good athlete. He is able to bounce back up to his feet. He even has sneaky submissions if he's able to get on top. And his ground and pound, oh my lord, if he's able to start landing.
He'll isolate an arm, key lock, or Kimura, and then sweep.
I'm not saying he's some like massive negative grappler, but the takedown defense has always been an issue for him, especially throughout his UFC tenure. And with Bohalio being the type of grappler that he is, I do think he just needs one. He has that heavy on top to where he gets leg control. He's good at wrapping the legs. He has good wrist control too. So he's very heavy on top and he makes guys pay for having that lax takedown defense in the first place. So for as good of a striker, as Olaszczyk is, I just don't think he's going to get those opportunities all that often in this matchup. And if he's not able to really gain confidence and have success with some of those early combinations, I love the boxing too. But we've all seen a fight every now and then where Olaszczyk, he'll just stand on the outside. He'll use that weird kind of Fedor movement where he has the low hands, and he just won't throw that much offensively. And if he does get stuck in a mirror in this matchup, I guess a guy like Bohalio, who can be on the outside, can close that distance very fast for his own takedown attempts, I just think it really comes down to the opening few minutes for Olaszczyk, because if he defends some of those takedowns and gains confidence, then maybe he won't move forward and have a lot of those big power shots land.
And I said that Olaszczyk, he was able to reverse position and get the finish over Brundage. That was on the third takedown, because in the first round, Brundage goes head kick, and then takedown. It was a really weird combination. It made him think up high to drop down low. The second one, it was off of, he just got pulled down to the mat, up kind of closer to the cage. And then the third one, he gets the takedown, and that's where Olszczyk's able to reverse position and get the finish. And if you look at it, the takedown defense for Olszczyk so far in the UFC, 43%. Brundage went 3 of 3. Jacoby went 1 of 2. Crew went 8 of 10 for 3 minutes and 29 seconds of control time in the first round. So Olszczyk is good at getting back up to his feet, and OSP went 1 of 2. So that's kind of the breakdown of the takedown.
But that's like, it's like being a closer where it's like he's really good at getting out of the gym with the bases loaded.
Don't start.
You know,
here.
Like it's just don't get the bases loaded in the first place, and then we don't really need to worry about you getting us out of that gym.
Is
like,
Michael Olszczyk Jordan Romano?
He might be Jordan Romano.
Don't do that to me.
Sorry. Like, Olszczyk, the positives are there.
ERA plus is great, but by the jeepers, if it's a close game,
yeah, like,
you're
if
losing.
You look at the numbers, Olszczyk, boy, is he good. But then when you really start to break them down and think about the intangibles, you get worried.
But why do you like a guy like Olszczyk? For the fans that are out there,
because
we
he has crippling power with his hands. He does.
And his boxing combinations
well.
Are great, right?
They're great, but they're unorthodox. Like, he doesn't throw, like, he doesn't shell up and throw body shots like a normal fighter. He'll lunge in from odd angles. He will throw power shots without like a jab in front of them. But he does have a good jab too. So he's a unique fighter. And that's why he's always been a fun one to watch.
Again, southpaw versus southpaw is going to accentuate the boxing of Olszczyk. It leaves the body open for both of these fighters. So we'll see if some of those sidewinder kicks from the karate stance will appear for a guy like Bohalio, because he doesn't have to worry about getting taken down. He thrives in those situations. So if you look at the odds in the matchup, Bohalio is a big favorite here. If we look at the fan vote over on Tapology, surprise us there to you, I'm going to say over under 85% Bohalio.
I think they'll be under, but still very high.
Oh, you turkey. 600 total votes, 83% Bohalio, 66% by decision. For the 17% that have Husar, 70% by knockout. So no surprise there with the way that the vote shook out. I have Bohalio with the takedowns. I don't know if it's going to be the best fight. Unranked middleweights usually don't have the best fights.
So I think it will be a fun fight, honestly. I have high hopes.
Now we buried the lead because we didn't talk about it in the intro. This card, it's a fair bit of filler. There's two ranked fighters. There's two unranked heavyweight fights on the main card. Two unranked middleweight fights on the main card. Those are either over quick or they're really bad. So for me, I have Kyle Bohalio.
This card is the Oakland Athletics of UFC cards.
Yeah, well, they did move it to Vegas and they put it in the tiny cage of the Apex. So I do have Kyle Bohalio in his third co-main event slot, but Husar is liable to getting a knockout.
Oh yeah, he has great power. He could win by knockout, but I have Bohalio. If he's able to get the takedown, he's normally able to secure the takedown. And Olszczyk's not great at defending takedowns in the first place. So I do have Bohalio, but Olszczyk's going to be a really difficult test for him.
Matt, it's time for the main event. We have Song Yadong taking on Ricky Simone. You talk about excitement.
That's
level. We have top 10 ranked guys in this division. You're not going to want to miss. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Main event time with Fight Night Picks. As always, one half your host and duo, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, it's Lakers super fan. Forget about the Raptors. Matt Allen FNP.
Forget about Nick Nurse, at least.
On the socials. And in the main event, impromptu, Moicano is out. Zarukian can't find a dance partner. So insert last weekend's supposed co-main event. It was supposed to be three rounds between Song Yadong taking on Ricky Simone. They're in space in the graphic, but now all of a sudden they're not. They found space. They're in a five-round main event, and that definitely serves Song Yadong quite well. His last fight was his first main event,
and that was what I wanted to bring up too. I was going to say, who do you think benefits the most from the 10 minutes? And my sort of kind of hot take was, you would normally think, oh well, the guy who uses the wrestling, right, the pressure is probably going to favor him. But, and I don't just say this because Song Yadong lost by doctor stoppage his last time out, but who is the more damaging fighter between these two? Yes, Ricky Simone has great takedowns, great submissions, and his striking has improved, but at the end of the day, Song Yadong is still the much more damaging striker between these two guys, and although he has had a liability of getting held down in the past, it's not like he gets tired in three-round matchups or gets tired defending takedowns. So I do think Song Yadong is going to benefit from these extra 10 minutes just because he's not going to get tired, I don't think, because of the 10 minutes, and it gives him 10 more minutes to damage Ricky Simone and kind of make up for what he might give up in terms of wrestling control and takedowns.
Yeah, and we saw Ricky Simone back with the LFA in 2017-2018, beating guys like Chico Camus and Venetia Zaney, really recognizable names.
5 years ago,
on the regional scene, no, but in five-round fights, he beats Marab when he makes his UFC debut. He did fight on Dana White's Contender Series, beat Donovan Freelo by split decision, didn't get a contract. That was in the first season of Contender Series. Since then, a really tidy run. Obviously, he had that rough loss to Uriah Faber when that was supposed to be the breakout moment for Simone. Then he got beat in a fight of the night against Rob Font where he couldn't get past that jab. But since then, tidy little win streak, Ray Borg that just can't get it together, sadly. Gaetano Perello, Kelleher, Asansao, Shore, and now all of a sudden Song Yadong. And for Yadong, I mean, you consider the level of competition for this guy in the UFC. It has been quite high since he's really been able to join, but the breakout performance that he had, his second to last fight, he knocks out the former title challenger, Marlon Moraes.
What a beautiful combination.
And it really was. I mean, sadly for Moraes, the way that he went out, and then he went out with PFL. But when you look at it for Song Yadong, what does he do so well? It's mixing his boxing combinations from the head to the body. Once he's able to figure out the distance against a pressure guy like Ricky Simon, we'll see how that plays out, because Simon, not like Curtis Blaydes, but like Curtis Blaydes, Ricky Simon's really found a happy place and a sweet spot with his boxing. He's a guy that's trained down in, you know, whether it be Syndicate out of Vegas, I know I struggled with that, out of the Pacific Northwest with ATT Portland, and we've seen Fabiano Scherner go on a roller coaster ride of emotions with fighters riding very high highs to the low lows of the retirement fight of Ed Herman recently. But for Simone, an interesting turn there. His cousin Vince Morales has a big fight coming up with XMMA, but Morales, one of those primary training partners that was in the UFC for a very long time. It's just Simone reached the pinnacle of his wrestling, then accentuated his boxing, and I wouldn't say Ricky Simone's going to go out there and try and box a Song Yadong. I think for maybe minutes or seconds at the start of the first round as a feeling out process. I'm just eager to see what the motor of Simone, if he's able to carry it through, and if we do end up in the championship rounds of a fight like this.
It will be interesting, because if Simone's not able to get a submission, I think it will be difficult for him, because I think he could get like a rear naked choke or an arm triangle in this, just because the control time might start to break down Song Yadong over time. And if he is able to get into like side control for a long period, the submissions might start to open up. I just worry about Simone on the feet and whether or not he's going to be able to be that kind of damaging striker against someone like Song Yadong, because Song moves really well on the feet. Like, he doesn't stop moving. He uses boxing to get in and get on the outside. And for those reasons, I was like 55-45 towards Ricky Simone the first time when we broke this fight down. But I gotta be honest, now that it's a 5-round fight and the fact that Song has been in that type of fight before, I thought he looked good even in a loss to Corey Sandhagen. Like, I thought in parts he looked really good on the feet. The boxing was able to flow when Sandhagen wasn't using his footwork, and I don't think Ricky Simone can move like Corey Sandhagen on the outside. So I just think for Song Yadong, there is a clear blueprint to winning this fight, and that has to be said. But the wrestling of Simone, if he can take him down for 1 round, 2 rounds, 3 rounds, it's going to put a lot of pressure on Song going down the home stretch.
6.55 takedown attempts average per 15 minutes for Ricky Simone. He's second all-time in bantamweight history with 37 takedowns. And if you consider it, like, you look at his fights, you look at all the experience that he has inside of the octagon at 8-2. He's got a fight of the night. He's got a performance bonus as well. And you look at it for Song Yadong, a lot of parallels. And we brought this up last week, but if you consider it for Song Yadong, he fought Marlon Vera, and in that fight, Colin Oyama was in the corner of Marlon Vera. For Ricky Simone, his cousins Vince Morales, the Fabiano Scherner connection, Song Yadong beat Vince Morales over in Beijing a few years ago. So a lot of commonalities between these guys. The camps are deeply entrenched. It's almost a rivalry fight without these guys having fought each other before. So there's a lot deeper than just a surface level unranked couple of guys that are fighting. You have the number 8th ranked bantamweight in Song Yadong. You have number 10 in Ricky Simone. I mean, you consider it, Simone is an ever so slight favorite. We threw it out there over to the YouTube community tab really early on a Sunday morning, so the votes aren't really trickling in. But if you do have a look at it, 51% have Song Yadong to get the win. Over on Topology, 55% have
very
Ricky
close.
Simone. So it is really, really close when you do break it down by the numbers. It's just for Song Yadong, he struggled with some of the takedown defense in the past. He comes out of Team Alpha Male. You're only going to get better iron sharpening iron in that respect. It's just, can he get up to the level of a guy like Ricky Simone with that takedown defense? That's a big question.
Ricky Simone does one thing with his boxing that I can't stand, and this is what it is. When he gets in on the pocket, lands his own shots, and then you fire back at him, he shells up.
And backs up.
But it's on a straight line and it's not effective defense at all. If Song Yadong just does the classic throw volume to get you to shell your hands up, you brought it up yourself. What is he great at doing? Dig into the body with boxing combinations. If he's able to do that early, I could see that really wearing on the gas tank of Ricky Simone. Again, my pick is Ricky Simone, even though I feel like I'm breaking up a lot of ways for Song Yadong to win this fight. But I think that just speaks to how close this fight is. And that has to be said too. Song Yadong fights in a pretty close manner to Rob Font. And he trains with Uriah Faber. Uriah Faber owns the gym he goes to. So I do think there's a great way for Sung to win this fight. But this is a fun one because the winner's probably not getting a title shot. But we know how long Jim 135 is right now. So you know they're going to fight one of those huge names coming up next.
And you hear in these fights, X-Fighter utilizes her grappling to tire Fighter Y. And you saw that last weekend in a lowly heavyweight fight between the unranked Muhammad Usman and Junior Taffa. So in a matchup like this, it's much higher level. It's less 130 pounds, but when you consider it for Song Yadong, if he gets taken down, if you zap those energy systems, we've seen him bounce back in some of these fights where he struggled with that pressure, with that grappling. We'll see if he's able to circle away. I think those boxing combinations, a five-round atmosphere, Ricky Simon has been there, Song Yadong's been there the one time, but I now think that this five-round fight actually favors Song Yadong. I think it accentuates his overall game plan, and I think he's more conducive in a fight like this with his style.
I like it.
To win a decision. So I'm actually switching my pick in this fight. I'm going with Song Yadong. You're going with Ricky Simon. But now all of a sudden, Matt, when you look at a fight card like this, again, our graphic, they're fighting in space and everything's all lit up like the moon. But when you consider it here, you have Simon, you have Song Yadong, you have five debuting fighters. Trey Waters coming in on a week's notice. 2 weeks ago, he won an LFA belt. Jamie Lynn Horth taking on Haley Cowan, debuting fighters. And then we also have Irina Alexeva taking on Stephanie Edgar, a fight that everybody needed to see. But there's a lot to look forward to in a bit of a downturn for the Fight Night picks where we get to try and hop back on the horse on a bit of a shorter fight card. Only 12 fights on this
one. Yeah, only 12 fights, but they should be some fun ones. Exactly. There's not like crazy name value. Conor McGregor's not fighting on this fight night, but there should be some really fun fights. Again, Arosa versus Padilla, that should be a really fun one. Cortez Acosta de Lima, for some weird reason, I'm excited for that fight just because for Cortez Acosta, he's one of the few young heavyweights who might be able to break into the rankings. So if he's able to win that fight, who really knows where we go from there? But there's some fun fights to break down on this.
Make sure you toss a like down below. If you're not subscribed, please do so. There's a lot of you that join in on Saturday and then you just hang out and it's a one-shot deal. But if you toss a subscription, that would be much appreciated. Right. Question Mark Kicks 2 hours live before the fights on Saturday. And after this one, UFC 288, another bantamweight main event. Jan Dwashvili, Sandhagen, you had not that long ago. And then, of course, this one here. It is really heating up. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.